listen, listen, listen. God is speaking to us.
Kairos Milwaukee United Church of Christ presents Beloved Community, a sermon by the Reverend Rick Skidmore, presented on Sunday, January 26th, 2014.
Now, when Jesus heard that John the Baptist had been arrested, that's how the passage begins, and that ought to tell us something about the times that Jesus was living in. He was living near the Sea of Galilee in a village called Capernaum, which was a territory known by the Romans as the Land of Contempt, and it had been annexed to the Assyrians because it was deemed territory that was unmanageable, full of zealots and bandits and rebel rousers. And it's here in this region that Jesus begins his ministry, his work, preaching about the nearness of God, inviting people to reorient their lives and focus on the joy and the justice of God. So Jesus summons people from their workaday lives and from the fabric of human relationships. These first followers must have known Jesus or known about Jesus, because Capernaum was a very tiny, tiny village. So there was Simon and Andrew, poor fishermen. They have only their nets. They don't have a boat. And then there's James and John, Zebedee's boys, from a more affluent family, because at least they have a boat. They're part of this small family business that's run by their dad. And then later they will be joined by, remember from Sunday school, Thaddeus and Bartholomew and Philip and Bilbo and Thomas and James and Frodo and... We know very little about these people, except their names, and in some cases we know their occupation. We would like to know so much more. But we can make some assumptions. I think that what initially drew people to Jesus weren't necessarily his words, but his presence. I think that people somehow must have sensed in him the power of God, and they wanted to be close to that. They wanted to be close to him. They saw the light of him sort of arch across the grayness of their own lives, and so they wanted to follow. And I think you and I have this tendency to believe that these biblical personalities, you know, walked by some kind of magical spiritual insight, and they heard clearly the voice of God without delay, and that's how the passage reads. But notice that these guys keep their day jobs, so maybe they weren't quite all in yet, at least not at the beginning. And I think there's another thing for us to notice here as this gospel story unfolds, and that is that none of the followers seem to have gotten any of Jesus' points very well. And if they did, they never really seemed to live by them very well, which makes them people like you and me. So Jesus organizes his ministry around human beings with the same mixture in them of cowardice and courage and intelligence and stupidity and selfishness and generosity and openness of heart and clay-footedness as you would apt to find most anywhere. I would guess even in this room. And here's another point worth noting, I think, that after these first followers answered Jesus, Jesus' invitation to boldly go where they've never been, they seem to have gone right on working at pretty much whatever they had been working at before, which means that Jesus didn't so much call them out of their ordinary lives, but I think called them out of believing that their lives were in any way ordinary. Jesus, in other words, called them to see that no matter how ordinary it may seem to us as we live it, life is extraordinary. the realm of God is near, is the way that Jesus put it. Life, even at its most monotonous and backbreaking and heart-numbing, still has the seed of God in it. It's where our best dreams come from and our purest prayers. And we glimpse it at moments when we find ourselves being wiser and braver and better than we know. We catch sight of it in some moment of crisis, when a strength wells up in us that is greater than our own strength. So there's another preacher, prophet, community organizer whose work and life, I think, took inspiration from and parallels in many ways the visions and dreams and strategies of Jesus. I'm talking about Martin Luther King, who I believe was and is one prophet who can help us through this 21st century. And since August, when we mark the 50th anniversary of the Poor People's March on Washington, it seems like there's been a lot more attention given, more written about and said about Dr. King's legacy, what it was that he actually accomplished as, you know, God's drum major for justice. Fox News was quick to weigh in and say, sure, Dr. King marched and he gave inspiring speeches, but let's not forget that Lyndon Johnson and an all-white Congress were the ones that passed the 1964 Civil Rights Act. John Lewis, the legislator from Georgia's 5th congressional district, who worked and who marched alongside Dr. King, had this to say in response, and I quote, "Dr. King marched and gave important speeches, but his main accomplishment was ending 200 years of racial terrorism by getting black people to confront their fears. Lunch counters and buses were crucial symbolic planes of struggle that the civil rights movement used to dramatize the issues, but the main suffering didn't come from our inability to drink from the same fountain or ride it in the front of the bus or eat lunch at Woolworths. It was that white people, mostly white men, terrorized us, went berserk and grabbed random black people, usually men, and lynched them, killed them. And we couldn't fight back for fear of retaliation, for fear of an even worse punishment. This constant low dread of violence is what kept that system running and made life miserable and stressful and terrifying. But Dr. King ended this reign of terror and fear by telling us, whatever you're most afraid of, go and do that. Go ahead, go down to the city hall and try to register to vote. Even if they say no, even if they take your name down, go ahead and sit at that lunch counter. Go ahead and sue the local school board. All these things that black people would have said back then were stark, raving mad and would get you killed. But Dr. King said, if we do this together, we'll be okay. He taught black people how to face the worst of the worst collectively. He taught them how to take a beating. In those early days in Mississippi and Alabama, we actually coached people on how to crouch and how to cover their heads and their arms, and how to take a beating. And we taught people how to go to jail, which terrified everybody. And you know what? Once people had been beaten, had dogs sicked on them, had fire hoses sprayed on them, had been thrown in jail, you know what happened? These extraordinary young black people began singing freedom songs in jail. This is what ended, not racism, but the terrorism that racism projects. Confronting your worst fears and living through them and breaking out in a deep-throated freedom song. The jailers knew they had lost when they beat the crap out of these young Negroes. And the jailed, beaten young people began to sing joyously, first in one town and then in another. The words of John Lewis. So history certainly teaches us that Dr. King had many goals, many other goals, more transcendent policy goals than helping people confront their fears. Dreams and visions he had for all people, like ending poverty and reducing the military aspects of our foreign policy and promoting the New Deal goal of universal employment and on and on. When Dr. King was a student at Boston University, he took his first course then from Howard Thurman, who was dean of the school. He took a course on nonviolent civil disobedience. And Howard Thurman had spent time in India with Mahatma Gandhi. And it was here that Dr. King, at BU, it was here that Dr. King began to develop his own strategies for social justice. And it was also here that Dr. King first began to use the term beloved community as an expression of his own faith ideals and his belief that this was indeed the central focus and teaching of Jesus. So Mark, in his gospel, uses the term kingdom of God. And Matthew substitutes the word heaven for God because he's a devout Christian Jew and he's trying to avoid using the word God out of reverence. But Dr. King uses the term beloved community. And I think all of these phrases really point to the same thing that Jesus was teaching and talking about, that the realm of God has to do with the here and now. What life on earth can be like in the here and now. And Dr. King's concept of the beloved community can be really traced through all of his speeches and writings from the earliest to the last. In one of his first published articles, he states that the purpose of the Montgomery bus boycott is, quote, reconciliation, redemption, and the creation of the beloved community. And in his last book, he writes, our loyalties must transcend race and tribe and class and nation. The ultimate aim of our movement is to foster and to create a beloved community. A community where love and justice would be an actuality in the fabric of our social life. The ideal expression of our beliefs and faith. So we, you know, I think you and I, when we speak about love as the answer, that we have a tendency to so over-sentimentalize and sort of romanticize that term. And I think it's important for us to remember that for those who are really at the forefront of social and spiritual transformation of society and culture, that for them, love was a strategy. For Jesus and Gandhi and Martin Luther King and Nelson Mandela, love was simply the best strategy, a more functional system for bringing about change than violence or retribution or retaliation or warfare. Quoting Dr. King, when I speak of love, I'm not speaking of some sentimental or anemic response. I'm speaking of that force which all the great religions have seen as the supreme unifying principle of life. Love is what unlocks the door. And as we press on for justice, we must always move with dignity and discipline, using only the weapon of love. End quote. So just as Jesus summoned people from their workaday worlds and from the fabric of their all too human lives into this new set of relationships and this new vocation, the same can be said of Dr. King, who enlisted people from all kinds of backgrounds, all sorts of families, all sorts of faith journeys, or none at all, enlisted them to leave their old lives of fear and separation behind and to become together that beloved community, even in our diversity, to rearrange the world into a new design of God's making, to open our lives to the radical renewal that, yes, may upset and reorient our neat little hard-won patterns of comfort and isolation and privilege. And both Jesus and Dr. King provoked a lot of people with these expectations, and they provoke us still. Dr. King said, quote, "When I talk about feeding the poor, they give me a Nobel Prize. But when I ask why the poor are hungry, they call me a communist." Revelation. Revolution. Renewal. Epiphany. I think it's amazing. I think it's nothing short of extraordinary and miraculous that the light of God manages still to crack through into our world, to shine in the most unlikely of places and in the midst of the most unlikely people who become the most unexpected conduits for love and healing in our world. The light of God shines through even today in the hearts and in the lives of those who would do battle as Jesus and Martin did battle with every social, religious, political system, no matter how sacred, that did not serve that beloved community as they saw it and as they lived it and embodied it in all of its wildness and magnificence and beauty, bringing about God's healing love for the whole blessed world, man. I'll close with this poem by another truth bearer, light sharer, William Stafford. It's entitled "The Way It Is." There's a thread you follow. It goes among things that change, but it doesn't change. People wonder about what you're pursuing. You have to explain about the thread, but it's hard for others to see. But while you hold it, you can't get lost. Tragedies happen, people get hurt, people die and suffer. There's nothing you can do to stop times unfolding, but don't ever let go of the thread. Peace of God.
Listen, listen.